Welcome to another episode of Up My Nursing Game, the podcast that uses expert interviews to address common nursing questions and pitfalls. Today, we will be speaking with Tori Arsenal, who is a pharmacist, currently completing her second postgraduate year at a busy emergency department in the Bay Area. I'm happy to have a pharmacist on this podcast because nurses rarely get the chance to really chat with pharmacists. Most interactions take place over MAR messages, you know, where we bark questions and answers at each other like, where is this medication? To which the answer inevitably seems to be in the refrigerator. And it's my opinion that pharmacists are a greatly underused resource in the hospital. Pharmacists are chock full of information and frequently have a better understanding of medications than even physicians, for reasons which she will talk about later. So today, Tori and I will be talking about two things which are honestly totally unrelated: vancomycin and oral diabetic medications. We chose vancomycin not only because it's so ubiquitous, but also because there's some upcoming changes to the way that it will be dosed that require more lab monitoring. Before more work is hoisted on us nurses, I thought it would be helpful to understand why these changes are being made. And oral diabetes medications? Well, we don't use them enough in the hospital. So it's time to brush up on our understanding of how these medications work and learn about when and how to advocate for them. So before we jump in, I just want to remind you to claim your free CE credit for listening to this episode by heading over to upmynursinggame.bcuhealth.org. All right, listen in. All right, welcome Victoria Arsenal to the show today. She's a pharmacist originally from Boston, now transplanted out here in the Bay Area. She's currently working in an emergency department at a busy hospital here in the Bay Area. And I'm really excited to have you on today. Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much, Annie. I'm really excited to be here with you. So my name is Tori, and like you mentioned, I did go to school in Boston at MCPHS University, which is a very, very old pharmacy school. And I graduated in 2018, and I worked as a travel pharmacist for 2 years. And I worked at 5 different places. I traveled all around the Boston area, and I actually ended up randomly in an ICU and ED, which was very, very lucky. That usually does not happen if you don't have residency experience. And once I started there, I realized, wow, I really love this and I wanted some more training. So I got lucky and ended up matching here in California. And so now I am a pharmacy resident in the emergency medicine department in my second year. So one more year and I'll be done. So moving to Boston, California has been a huge adventure for me and I've really, really loved it so far. But other than my wonderful job that I love so much, I also am a cat mom. I have a Siamese cat, Kippy, that I adopted last year. And I absolutely adore her. Unfortunately, she is a little overweight. I'm trying to deal with that. The vet is not very happy with me. But
I thought cats were supposed to like regulate their intake on their own. So
you'd think so, but yeah. She is just like a dog. She will. Yeah, it's really bad.
Like if she has food in front of her, she'll eat it, sort of thing.
Oh yeah. Anything. Like cereal, she'll beg for it. Like it does not matter what it is. She wants it. Not super healthy. But I like to think I have a bit of a green thumb, although I do kill some of my plants here and there, but I am a plant collector. I have about 100 in my apartment. And the last little fun thing about me is I'm super excited that it's September. I love the fall. Halloween is my absolute favorite holiday. I've already started watching my spooky movies. I wear my Halloween socks to work for good luck. So very, very excited for that.
That is so cute. I have to warn you, though, that in California, fall is not like it is on the East Coast.
I know. It's not the same. That's the only thing I really miss about home is like the beautiful leaves changing.
Yes. Leaf peeping. Yeah. It's like a, it's a big thing, like for people who don't live on the East Coast. Like it's truly amazing. I went to school on the East Coast and.
Oh yeah.
I remember, for a hot second, I was actually, a coxswain for the rowing team at my college. And it was just almost a spiritual experience to be on the boat and, like looking at the trees turn all these different shades of red and yellow. And I definitely, that's one of the things I miss about the East Coast.
Yeah. It gives you that whole like wholesome feeling during that time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'm always so curious to ask, you know, the guests on my show, how did you choose your specialty? Like, how did you know you wanted to become a pharmacist? Because like when I found out that there was this specialty of becoming a pharmacist, I was like, oh, so you would work in like a CVS or a Rite Aid, right? Like, how did you know about pharmacy and that it wasn't just like retail?
Yeah. So it's actually a really funny story. So in high school, I didn't really know exactly where I wanted to end up. I knew that I loved science and that I really loved people. But I've also been really creative and had an artistic side. So I was super torn between the two. And so in high school, someone suggested to me, why don't you take like a career test? Just like one of those very random, like 40 question online career tests. And it matched me with a nuclear pharmacist. And I was like, what is that?
What is that?
So I was so interested because so a nuclear pharmacist, what they do is instead of working with medications to treat a disease, they're actually working with radioactive materials to help identify or diagnose diseases. Okay. And I thought that was quite interesting. And that was my first, you know, inkling that there was much more to being a pharmacist than retail. Mm-hmm. Community pharmacy.
Community pharmacy. That's probably the right term for it.
Yeah. Community pharmacy. Okay. And that's where I started, you know, looking into it more. And at first, you know, I thought, oh, infectious diseases was really, really cool. And, you know, I just fell in love with all of the different clinical aspects of pharmacy. Mm-hmm. And so when I was a senior, I applied to pharmacy school and to art school. And unfortunately for me, I got into both. And so then I had to pick. I went with pharmacy school and I feel very lucky that I fell in love with it as much as I did because it's a really big commitment.
Yes.
Because on the East Coast, a lot of the programs are 0 to 6 straight to a doctorate. You don't do undergrad or anything like that. And so you're 18 and you're going right into your career.
But from what I understand, you've been able to somewhat tie your creative side, your artistic side into pharmacy. Like, can you tell us a little bit about like your Twitter account and some of the like teachings you do in pharmacy?
Oh, I would love to.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's so funny because back, you know, when I was younger, I thought there wasn't any room for creativity in the medical world, but I have been pleasantly surprised that that is not true. I've always been a really big visual learner, and in college, like the only way I could remember, you know, pharmacokinetics or, you know, any drug structure was by drawing it out. And so I've always had very elaborate, colorful notes. And that's just been my little outlet. And so now at my current practice site where I am a resident, we do something called pharmacy education boards, which are posted on our Twitter. And we choose a topic every week, every other week. And on a big whiteboard in our emergency department, I go ahead and I make a visual aid for learning. And it's been really, really fun for me and for our staff, I think, to get, you know, information in like this little bit more of a fun way, a bit more digestible. And so that's been amazing. And just being able to share that on Twitter and spark discussion, it's been a really nice and refreshing way to engage my creative side. And I think it's showing other people in the medical community that that visual learner, that creative side can be very beneficial.
Yeah, definitely. And this pharmacy board that you're talking about, is it out for like other staff to see, like doctors and nurses?
Yeah, it's right in the middle of our main patient care area. So our paramedics that come through, they see it. Our nurses, they see it. Everyone takes pictures of it. And so we have one in our ED, but now it's started to spread throughout the hospital. So now it's in the ICU And I know a lot of other institutions have started doing it now too. So it's been really cool to see everyone else's that they've been sharing on the internet.
That's awesome. And if one of our listeners wanted to see these, like, what is the Twitter handle for the account?
Yeah. So on Twitter, it's at PIL for Today I Learned, ED PharmD.
I think that kind of ties into, you know, what we're going to talk about today and what I'm trying to do with the podcast is kind of bring in different areas of specialty in the medical team and, you know, really learning from each other. Pharmacists are such an integral part of the medical team. And it's something that it took me a while to realize is how much doctors really lean on pharmacists. Can you talk a little bit about like your relationship with how you work with doctors? And someone recently explained to me that in medical school, there's not much teaching in the way of pharmacology.
So from what I understand, and I obviously did not go to medical school, so I could be wrong on this, but from what I have heard is that typically in medical school, they will get 1 to 2 semesters of pharmacology, and that's really it in their education. And that's where pharmacists come in. And so we have this very robust, education about pharmacology and pharmacokinetics, and that's really where our niche is. And so the way that I like to think about it is our physician counterparts, they diagnose, they figure out what's going on. And once we know what's happening, their pharmacists can sort of help them come up with a way to take care of that issue. And so we're sort of symbiotic in that way. At least that's how I like to think of it. You know, we're a big team, but especially, at my current practice site, I feel like pharmacy is so loved and very, very like leaned on, like you said. And particularly in the emergency department, I feel very lucky because I get to have a lot more hands-on patient care.
Absolutely.
But for example, yesterday, we had like an urgent intubation and I will be the one to say, hey doc, would you like to use 20 of etomidate and 80 of rock? I think this patient is, 75 kilos or whatever. And they'll be like, yep, sounds good, Tori. Like you go do that. And so that's how we work together, because now my physician can focus on everything else he needs to worry about other than the medication.
I'm sure those doctors just really appreciate you taking that off their plate, right?
Yeah. Like anything we can like help remove from that stressful situation for them is really our goal.
In my experience, I've seen doctors write a lot of orders for medications per pharmacy protocol. So for example, like insulin per pharmacy protocol. But are there times when a physician will get on the phone and call you up and just ask your opinion, like what medication do you think is appropriate for this patient?
Oh my gosh, that's probably like 80% of my time on the phone.
Really?
Or you know what I really love is when they come find me in person. That just makes my day, which happens often in the ED because they know exactly where to find me. Unfortunately, in most hospital settings, you don't know where your pharmacist is. They're usually in the basement.
Yes.
Which is why I like being on the floor. So, yeah. You get more face and people are like, that's my pharmacist. I know how to ask questions. We have a better rapport. But yeah, I get calls all the time like, oh, my patient's growing this bug, but they have this allergy. Like, what do I do?
Okay.
And all these very interesting questions. And so, yeah, we work through like these very weird cases together over the phone and try to figure out what's best for the patient together.
Yeah. And correct me if I'm wrong, but like a lot of your interaction is you like clarifying orders with the doctor, or like you're seeing an order come through and you're like, wait, I want to discuss like about possible interactions with other medications.
Yeah. So when we make an intervention, which is basically holding a medication order before we speak to someone about it, it could be for any reasons of like a dose is incorrect. It should be higher or lower. Maybe the bacteria that they're growing it's not appropriate for allergies, drug interactions, basing things off of kidney function, which sometimes can be based on pharmacy protocol. So sometimes we don't even need to contact anyone to make those changes.
Okay.
So there's so many different things, or even, sometimes if you see certain medications ordered without certain labs, we will, be like, hey, we need to order this lab and things of that sort.
Speaking of ordering medications per pharmacy protocol, I think vancomycin has got to be like up there with the most frequently ordered. So I wanted to talk to you today about vancomycin. I think this is somewhat of a nurse heavy medication because, you know, there are things that nurses need to do, before administering it. We also need to draw labs for it, like the peaks and the troughs. For, you know, first of all, what is the indication for vancomycin and why do we see it all the time?
You're so right. I spent a lot of time looking at vanco.
Yeah.
And so vancomycin IV is an antibiotic that we use for gram-positive infections, particularly MRSA. It's really the drug of choice for MRSA. And especially when we don't know what's going on or what the source of infection is in a patient, we'll often use it for empiric treatment of that infection. Otherwise, just to like get it out there, oral vancomycin is only for C. diff. It does not get absorbed systemically. Live in the gut.
Okay.
You should just keep them separate in your mind because you can't really use either or for different indications.
Okay. And when you talk about empiric therapy, are you talking about like giving an antibiotic before knowing exactly what the bug is?
Yes, exactly. So when you come in and, you know, you have a patient, they're looking septic, but we don't have a source and we drew blood cultures and nothing has grown yet. Often we will start with something like vancomycin with another agent, usually like cefepime or something like that, ceftriaxone, in order to sort of cover all of our bases because vancomycin is very broad in terms of gram-positive bacterial coverage.
Okay. So it would be common to have vancomycin to cover like the gram-positive bacteria and then maybe another agent for the gram-negative?
Exactly.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I have to admit, like, I think of vancomycin as kind of like this big, bad, ugly drug because of all like the side effects of it. And maybe that like the name of it too, like vancomycin is so like dark. It's not like cute, like, like ertapenem or mirum. I don't know. Yeah. I think those are like cuter sounding, but vancomycin. Let's talk about some of these, like side effects. And adverse effects of vancomycin.
So what's really, really funny is, so vancomycin is a super old drug, right? So when it was first formulated, and of course, this is way before my time, and I am not a vancomycin expert in any way, but when they first extracted the medication and put it into a form to give to people IV, the way that they put it into a solution, that stuff that they mixed it with was very nephrotoxic. So back in the day, vancomycin itself was dirty, you know, in air quotes, because it had these excipients that were not good for people. Since then, it has been reformulated and that has actually helped a lot with the nephrotoxicity. So part of what we think of vancomycin being so bad is part of like that old history of it as well. Not to say that it's not nephrotoxic in on its own, because it absolutely is. But it's slightly less than what we used to think.
Okay.
So that can be a bit of a relief for you.
Yeah.
In general, it is a very big drug. It's not benign at all. It is absolutely associated with side effects, particularly the nephrotoxicity that you were mentioning. And so why does this happen? It's not well understood why. We think it's probably by free radical production, but it's really associated with too high levels of vancomycin. And so if we are using vancomycin correctly and monitoring the patient correctly and their renal function is stable, we shouldn't hit that as an issue. But something else that nurses should be aware of is actually nephrotoxicity with vanco is increased significantly when giving zosyn as well.
Mm.
So zosyn and vanco together are much worse risk for AKI than vanco or zosyn alone. So they're synergistic together to cause AKI.
Oh, that's interesting. And that's important to know because these are both medications that we're giving with very high frequency.
Yeah. And often, like, especially in the emergency room, like if we don't know what's going on, you'll get vanc and zosyn. So that covers all of your bases.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure I've seen those both ordered like at the same time.
And on top of it, a lot of times, you know, patients will need to get a CT scan and IV contrast can also contribute to that nephrotoxicity. So it's really when you have all of these agents at once that contribute to it, that make a really big issue.
Yeah.
Other things to think about would be like loop diuretics, like furosemide, if you're on like a Lasix strip, or having any aminoglycosides. Those are quite nephrotoxic as well.
Okay. That's interesting because vancomycin is often given like at early presentation, like starting in ED. Like the times I've been in ED, we've started patients on vancomycin, and there's a very high chance that they also have gotten IV contrast, while the, you know, they're doing the whole workup in ED and doing imaging. So I can see where vancomycin and IV contrast would be given like very close together.
Yes. And it does quite happen. And, you know, if a patient has, you know, wonderful renal function, they probably can tolerate it and will clear it just fine. But, you know, in our very septic patient, maybe with a history of CKD in AKI, that could be a recipe for some big issues.
Okay.
But, you know, that's why you have your pharmacist. We're going to adjust the dose based on the patient's renal function and whatever drug levels that we do get so that we can mitigate this issue. And so that's why the dosing is so difficult.
Okay, so let's say you get an order for vancomycin per pharmacy protocol. You see the patient has underlying chronic kidney disease, CKD. Their creatinine's, I don't know, like high ones, hovering around 2. And this is like I said, a chronic condition. They're not like an AKI. Would you be okay with giving that medication, or would you suggest an alternative?
So vancomycin is safe to give in CKD patients and even in dialysis patients.
Okay.
But we just have to be careful how we do it. So instead of doing scheduled dosing, like you would see, you know, vancomycin every 12 hours, what we do is we call like dosing per level. And so we'll load the patient with one dose of vanco. We'll wait some time, usually like 24 hours, and we'll just draw a random level. And based on how their kidneys actually cleared it, we'll make a decision after that on how, whether or not, you know, we can schedule it safely, or should we do, you know, special calculations to figure out how long it takes that patient to clear vanco.
I remember early on in my nursing career, I had a patient who was getting vancomycin, and I saw that she had one dose like 2 days ago and then didn't get another dose. And I questioned the physician about it. I was like, wait a second, you don't want to just give one dose of vancomycin. And he was like, well, you know, she's a dialysis patient, so she still has it all like, you know, running through her system. She hasn't cleared it. So it's like still working in her body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've had experiences where, I've dosed a patient like once in 5 days and they sustain therapeutic levels the entire time.
Wow.
And you know, okay, their kidneys aren't working great, but you know, that's actually saving the patient money if you think about it. So, okay, you know, and it's less levels for our nurses to draw. So in a way, honestly, I personally think that dosing per level is much easier, but that's just my opinion.
Yeah. Though it's like the silver lining of kidney disease.
Yes. Yeah. We turn it into a positive light if we can.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of this dosing. Like this is a, you know, these are some of the nursing responsibilities, right? Like mm-hmm. you have to get a weight on the patient and you need to draw the peaks and troughs. And, you know, I'm interested to hear more about these randoms. Starting with the weight. Sometimes it's hard to weigh patients accurately if they can't stand on a standing scale. We have to do like a bed scale, which isn't always perfect. Like, is it okay to get like an estimate, or is this something that we need to be like super precise about?
So in my personal experience, a very good estimate is usually fine. The only time I'm not okay with that is in pediatrics. Or like pregnancy, things where, you know, a patient's volume of distribution would be, you know, very altered, meaning that their tank for vancomycin might be different than a regular or a different patient, a normal patient. So that can be, you know, where you want to be very, very precise. But for the average patient, you know, as long as you're within like 5 to 10 pounds, I think that's probably reasonable, especially for the first dose, like for a loading dose. You know, if you're in the ER or, you know, you just got your patient, it's probably not feasible to get a weight immediately, just like you said. But even if, you know, we can ask the patient, what was your weight the last time you weighed yourself? We can use that to make an educated guess, and that's usually just fine.
Okay.
Yeah. And plus their concentrations will tell us, you know, if that dose is okay for them. So we can adjust along the way.
Okay. After a patient receives their first dose of vancomycin, this loading dose, that's, correct me if I'm wrong, but generally a large amount, like larger than they're going to be getting in subsequent doses. What is the next lab that is drawn to help you dose subsequent doses?
Yeah, absolutely. So depending on the method that we're going to be doing. So for example, if we're going to schedule maintenance doses, so this is not in a patient who's an AKI and we need to do random levels. So in a patient with good renal function, we load them and then we will, you know, calculate a reasonable frequency. What most hospitals do, will do what we call trough-based monitoring. And so a trough is going to be the lowest concentration of vancomycin in the system. And so what we like to do is we typically wait until the fourth or fifth dose because we want vancomycin to be at steady state in the patient's body so that the level's not fluctuating. And so typically we'll get the trough after the fourth dose if it's feasible. Sometimes if patients are getting vancomycin once a day, waiting, you know, 4 days to get a level isn't really appropriate. So we can push it earlier if we need to, and that's fine. But in terms of troughs, typically they're going to be 30 minutes to an hour prior to a dose. And so that number will tell us what the baseline, the lowest level of vancomycin that the patient has in their body. And so for trough-based monitoring, lower risk infections such as like soft tissue infections will have a goal of about 10 to 15. And more severe infections like meningitis, pneumonia, sepsis, bacteremia will have a goal of 15 to 20. And so these numbers were calculated back in the day to what we thought would represent overall vancomycin concentration. And so that's where those numbers come from.
Okay. But where do peaks come in random draws?
Right. So in patients who are getting, most patients, unless they are doing AUC to MIC monitoring, which we'll talk about in a little bit, getting peaks is not a common practice. Because what we think for trough-based monitoring is that the trough tells us more about efficacy and peaks will tell us more about toxicity. So if our troughs are low enough and their kidneys are fine, we probably don't need to get a peak because it's not really going to give us any extra information if we already know that the patient is responding well to vanco and they're not having any side effects or any kidney damage from it. But if we wanted to just check one, a peak will be done an hour after the end of an infusion dose. So say at 2 o'clock, you have a 2 gram dose, which typically would be infused over 2 hours. So 2 o'clock will be done by 4. You could draw your peak at 5. Okay, so that's the typical timing of a peak. It's really not common practice to get that unless you're doing AUC to MIC monitoring. For random levels, that's exactly what they are. They're random. So we could really do them at any time, but you kind of want to be smart about it because if I give someone vanco right now, I'm not going to draw a level in 2 hours because that's not going to give us any good information.
So random is not quite the right word to describe it.
I don't know why they call it random, but really what I do, so say it's like in the morning, a 9 a.m. loading dose and we want to do random, I might do, you know, a 24-hour level. Or if it's at nighttime, I might just say, you know, with AM labs, and then we can go from there. So it's really just, we want to give them usually about at least 12 hours to see what their kidneys do. And then the pharmacist will take that number and do some crazy math calculations to figure out what their kidneys are doing with it. And then we'll adjust the frequency based on that.
Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like there's some upcoming changes in how vancomycin is going to be dosed. Can you talk about what we have coming up? And how it will change our practice.
Absolutely. So, like I was mentioning before, AUC to MIC monitoring. Some places have already rolled this out, and this is definitely what's coming in the future for places that haven't rolled this out yet.
Sorry, what is AUC and IUC?
MIC. So AUC is area under the curve, and MIC is minimum inhibitory concentration.
So basically what that means is we are looking at the area under the curve of concentration. So the total concentration or vancomycin exposure over time that a patient will receive in relation to that bacteria's minimum inhibitory concentration, which basically means how much antibiotic we need to kill it. And so it's looking at it in a much more robust and thorough way. And so basically the reason why we're doing this is because studies have shown that using all of this information better predicts the efficacy and safety of vancomycin. And so because it's really assessing total vancomycin exposure with much more variables, we can use those two data points, the peak and the trough, to calculate a much more accurate metabolism of vancomycin and excretion.
Okay. Does this mean that, you know, hopefully you can give lower doses of vancomycin?
Yes, exactly. So what we aim for AUC to MIC is a number between 400 and 600. And we can hit that sometimes with trough goals as low as 10 for very severe infections. So we can expose patients to even less vancomycin than before, which, as you can imagine, lowers the risk for nephrotoxicity as well.
Oh, that's awesome. Are we going to be drawing labs at different times? Like, how's this going to look in the real world?
Yeah, so the main thing is the lab timing. And so it's really, really important. And it's pretty hard to be stringent with these, because I know, like, with nurses, you guys have so much to do and needing to draw, you know, a lab, and you only have 30 minutes to do it. And it's like in the middle of your med pass and all of this other stuff, it can be hard. But the timing is actually super important for us. Instead of, you know, the typical just drawing one lab, a trough, what's going to happen is that you will be doing a dose. You'll give a dose, you'll get the peak, and after that, you'll get the trough. So you're going to get two labs after a dose versus the one. We get our dose at noon, right? That's your dose. And then you're going to get the peak, because now you're getting your dose. Your levels are going to increase in the body. And so you're going to get that peak. And so, like I said, that peak is going to be an hour after the end of the infusion. And then you wait until the next dose. And 30 minutes before that next dose, you're going to get your trough. And so if you can imagine that on a graph, if you're pretending it's a hill, you're getting those two points, the top and the bottom.
Okay. And then you're looking at that area underneath.
Yes, under that bell-shaped curve.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So we're taking all of that information, not just the lowest part, but the peak concentration, and looking at all of that information versus, as in the past, it was just that bottom level.
Okay. That's really cool. I like the idea of, you know, giving less vancomycin and, you know, not giving more drug than what's truly warranted for the
exactly.
patient.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, you know, it's posed a lot of challenges for pharmacists and for nursing. You know, it's a little bit more stringent and requires a ton more work. But I think overall, it's much safer for patients. And I've definitely seen way less dangerous levels when I dose these patients. When we get our levels, usually they're right in the sweet spot, and it's not like, oh my God, stop the vinco. It's more like, okay, we're doing great. It's right where it's supposed to be. And it seems like it's so much more predictable than trough-based monitoring, at least in my experience.
Yeah, that's cool. And I think, you know, it is more work for nursing, but I guess my mind is put more at ease when I know why I'm doing that. Like, it's not just busy work. It's like, you're like potentially saving the patient from getting like toxic levels of vancomycin.
Absolutely. The really cool thing with AUC MIC monitoring, and so say, you know, something happens, we don't get one of those levels at the right time. What we can do is we can push it to the next dose, and then the pharmacist just has to do more difficult math, but we can make it work. So it's not like when you miss a trough level and now you have to wait like for the next day and it maybe causing issues with the patient. Instead, we can find another data point that we can use to make those adjustments.
Ah, that's cool. That's cool. So not all is lost in the world if you miss
one of those. No. It might make things a little bit difficult, but we will be okay.
Yeah. All right. So be nice to your pharmacist and get those peaks and troughs at the right time, so they don't have to do even more math than they're already doing.
I think one thing that we should talk about briefly is just like two other side effects with Vanco. Mm-hmm. One that's very, very rare would be ototoxicity, hearing loss, or tinnitus. We usually think about this more related to like aminoglycosides, such as like gentamicin. But ototoxicity is very, very rare, but it's associated with extremely toxic levels of vancomycin. So that's just something to, you know, keep in mind if, you know, ever anything happened to your patient and you see that they have an extremely high vanco level, you might want to suggest, hey, doc, we need to check their hearing.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. But that's okay. Very, very rare. And I hope that never happens to anybody. But if it does, it's just something to keep in the back of your head as a recommendation if it's missed.
Do you know, is this like a temporary hearing loss or?
So it can be transient, but sometimes it can be permanent.
Okay.
Yeah. It depends on how prolonged the high or toxic level was.
Okay. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then lastly, I just wanted to mention vancomycin induced infusion reaction syndrome, which used to be called red man syndrome. We no longer use that. So take that out of your vocabulary. Yeah. If you can, please. Yeah. And so, vancomycin infusion reaction is a histamine related infusion reaction. So you can see, you know, diffuse redness or erythema, usually in like the central trunk, neck and chest area, but it can be in, you know, extremities that's normal. Oftentimes, you know, when we see like this infusion reaction, we have a knee-jerk reaction to be like, stop vanco. But this is a normal or predictable ADR of vancomycin or an adverse drug reaction. We know that it releases histamine. We know that this can happen. And this doesn't, you know, necessitate an anaphylaxis to vancomycin. What this means is that we need to prolong the infusion time. And so if we run vanco much slower, we reduce the risk of this histamine release. And additionally, if you just like give the patient some Benadryl, it's usually not an issue. So if you do see that this happens to your patient, don't worry too much. We can, you know, we can treat this, but this is not to be, you know, confused with like Steven Johnson syndrome or any of those much more severe skin disorders, because that would be a big no-no to get vanco ever again if that did develop in your patient.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a good point. I think there would have to be a lot of like patient education at this point, because I could see a patient becoming very anxious.
Yes.
If all of a sudden their, you know, their chest is bright red and itchy. And just explain that like this is not anaphylaxis and it's something that like we can manage, while still getting vancomycin.
Exactly.
I think that about wraps it up for vancomycin. The other topic I wanted to go over with you today was oral diabetic medications. And this topic came to me because maybe a year or so ago, I administered, metformin to a patient. She had scheduled metformin. And then after I gave her the metformin, I got an order from her doctor saying NPO after midnight, and I started to sweat bullets and I was like, oh my gosh, she's going to get hypoglycemic. I think I need like D10 or something ordered because I'm afraid she's just going to tank. And so I called up my pharmacist and I, you know, just explained to her what was going on. She was like, no, don't sweat it, Annie. Like there's a floor effect. Like she's not going to become hypoglycemic. And while I was obviously relieved, I realized that I just don't have like a basic understanding of oral diabetic medications, probably because we don't give them a whole lot in the hospital. So I'm excited to go over this subject with you today, Tori, because not only do I want to become more comfortable with it, I think I'd like to like advocate for more oral diabetic medications in the hospital, since I think like our knee-jerk reaction is just to stop them while in the hospital. Mm-hmm. So yeah, let's start the discussion here talking about like why are oral diabetic medications often held in the hospital setting?
Yeah, that's a great question, because when I started working in a hospital, I thought the same thing. I was like, why are all these people who don't take insulin at home getting insulin? Like yeah. That's scary. We're, you know, injecting them. They probably don't like it too much.
No, they really don't like it. I can attest to that. They're not used to getting their finger poked like four times a day and to getting, you know, insulin shots. And it's like, it, it's a big thing for patient satisfaction.
Yeah, you know, especially, you know, if they're not in the hospital for any reason related to their diabetes, and, you know, now exactly. You're giving them insulin, they're like, wait a minute, like, am I not okay with my diabetes? And it's just this whole mess.
So, absolutely.
But the main reason why we do that is because it's so much easier to titrate and control hyperglycemia mm-hmm. with insulin versus our oral diabetes medications. Mm-hmm. And so we use that to have tighter glucose control. Also in the hospital, patients may not be eating, right? So that may change which medications are appropriate. So like you said, metformin does have that floor effect, but some of these medications can cause really pronounced hypoglycemia if you're not eating.
Okay.
And another major reason is because when patients are acutely ill, their insulin requirements and their glucose metabolism can change rapidly. And yes. So we might not be able to predict how they will respond to their home regimen anymore. We might need to even, you know, adjust it before they go home. And so sometimes, you know, an insulin sliding scale can be helpful in that way. But sometimes we end up chasing our high sugars. And I also don't think that's necessarily the best thing to do either.
Yes. And I think like that could be its own podcast episode is talking yes. about, yeah, sliding scale insulin. So I thought that, yeah, there's more control over glucose levels with insulin, but I thought a big thing about stopping specifically metformin was about if a patient is receiving IV contrast.
Renal dysfunction, very much common with IV contrast. So yes, if your patient is getting IV contrast in the hospital, they will typically stop metformin, and that is reasonable and fine. But it's okay to restart, like, if they're in a prolonged, you know, hospitalization, it's fine to restart a few days after, as long as, you know, their kidneys are doing fine. Also, if patients are in AKI or they have any changing renal function when they come to the hospital, it's imperative that you stop metformin because it is a renal drug. And so it does require that renal adjustment. And so in that setting, it might not be the most appropriate medication to give your patient.
Okay.
However, you know, if they're not getting IV contrast and their kidneys are happy, you should keep metformin on because we know that metformin, you know, does wonderful things for outcomes for diabetes. And we don't want, you know, to cause any glucose dyscrasias if we don't need to, you know, and we can lower their insulin requirement while they're in the hospital if that's something that they were ordered for.
Yeah. So how long after getting IV contrast should you be holding metformin?
So typically what I've seen is I've seen it started as early as the day after or even 3 days after, but I'm not really sure what would be the true correct answer to that. I think usually it's just at the physician's discretion.
Okay. And if a patient has been taking metformin like ongoing, and then they get an order for IV contrast, is that like a contraindication or do you just need to hold subsequent doses of metformin?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that it's a contraindication. I think you would just hold subsequent doses because, you know, you have to weigh the benefits versus risks. If you absolutely need a CT scan or, you know, contrast to make sure that your patient's okay, you're going to have to do that.
Okay.
So, yeah. And pharmacists will be alerted immediately once that order goes through that there's metformin and contrast on board.
Okay. Yes. That's one of those best practice alerts I've seen.
Yes, it's like, pop up.
Yeah. I think it's something that nurses can look out for though is like, okay, patient received IV contrast 3 days ago. Can we, and they're on sliding scale. I don't know if a nurse could do some like poking around and see, okay, maybe can we restart them on their, like their home dose of metformin.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a great point for nurses to be advocating for their patients, because I think, you know, once the renal function has settled down, a patient should absolutely get back on their home regimen if they're, you know, taking PO and it's appropriate at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they would be thankful for that. Save them from some pokes during the day.
Yes, I'm sure they would love that.
Yeah. Sticking with metformin for a little bit, because this seems to be, you know, in my experience, like the big workhorse of oral diabetic medications. Like, how does it decrease blood glucose levels, but not cause hypoglycemia?
It's a great question. So the way that metformin works is it's actually an insulin sensitizer. So what it does is it makes the patient's body more responsive to the insulin that they already have. So it's not necessarily increasing the amount of insulin that's released. It's just making your body better able to utilize the insulin that you already have. So that's why metformin doesn't, you can't use it for, you know, type 1 diabetics that don't have any natural insulin production. There are some caveats to that. But, you know, if a patient is not able to make insulin, metformin will not do anything for them.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, so if you don't have a pancreas, this will not
happen. Yeah. Or a non-functioning pancreas.
Exactly. Exactly. And so it also inhibits gluconeogenesis and it can increase the amount of like insulin that flows during that postprandial time after your meal. Oh. And so this is why it really has the floor effect and there is no hypoglycemia risk. So if your patient is NPO, they can stay on their metformin because it doesn't matter with regards to meals, okay, if or whether or not they can take it.
That is so good to know. So no freaking out like I did.
The only thing I will say though is metformin is really, really hard on the stomach. And so we usually recommend that people take it with food simply because of that, because it causes awful stomach cramps and, you know, gas and diarrhea, like extremely bad. Knowing from personal experience, I have family who has taken metformin and really did not enjoy how it made them feel. And so if your patient's not eating, that might be, you know, a little bit of hospital quality that you might want to think about.
Okay.
And so what I've done in the past is, you know, I've let my nurses know, let them see, try one dose and see, you know, how they tolerate it without food. And if it's okay, you can continue. But if they start having, you know, really bad abdominal discomfort, we shouldn't be doing that to them because we could just use insulin.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
But usually these kind of like GI symptoms are when the patient is not eating. Is that right?
Typically, but it can happen with food as well. It just really depends on the patient, but it's much more pronounced on an empty stomach.
Okay. Okay. So let's look at the other diabetic medications that are out there. Like I said, metformin seems to be like the big one that I see. I'm looking at this list we have here. So glipizide, I've definitely seen that ordered for my diabetic patients. Can we talk about glipizide?
Yes, absolutely. So glipizide is you're absolutely right, one of the most common medications that you'll see. That's in it's a member of the family of sulfonylureas, which is very, very, very old drug class.
Mm-hmm.
These drugs, which include glipizide, glyburide, and glimepiride, they work wonderfully. They reduce A1C up to 2%. They're fabulous. However, they are the highest risk for hypoglycemia of the oral diabetes medications.
So why is that?
So sulfonylureas are what we call insulin secretagogues, which basically means it's squeezing your pancreas and causing it to release insulin.
Okay.
And so that's why you can have the hypoglycemia risk.
Okay, because so, you're just increasing the amount of overall insulin.
Exactly. And so if you have a patient on glipizide, glyburide, or glimepiride in the hospital and they're NPO, you gotta DC those meds.
Okay.
Because that is a very high risk for hypoglycemia.
Okay.
These drugs have fallen out of favor is because of that. And so the only huge benefit of these drugs is that they are very, very cheap.
Oh.
And so for, you know, patients, you know, who have type 2 diabetes and, you know, if we needed to put them on a medication and they, you know, they can't afford a DPP-4 inhibitor, which could be expensive, or something like a GLP-1 or SGLT-2, mm-hmm, or even insulin, you know, glargine is super expensive. Sulfonylureas are extreme. They're dirt cheap. They're dirt cheap because they're so old. And so it might be, you know, it makes sense in certain patient populations, but like, I wouldn't give this to a homeless patient. I wouldn't give this to someone who has food insecurity. I wouldn't give this to someone who has like dementia or anything like that, because the risk is not outweigh the, you know, the risk outweighs the benefit in that
case. Yeah, absolutely. That makes sense to me. Okay. I'm looking at the medications here. Like I'm looking for, there's so many diabetic medications out here, but like a vast majority, I just don't see all that much. Mm-hmm. I definitely see the SGLT2 inhibitors. And I actually had a previous guest on the show talk about these, but he's actually a cardiologist, and he talked about the benefits of it for heart failure patients. But it is also indicated for diabetes. So, yeah, can you talk a little bit about these SGLT2 inhibitors and if this class of medications also has this like floor effect?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is probably one of my favorite class of diabetes medications. And so the SGLT2 inhibitors that has empagliflozin or Jardiance, which is probably the most common that I would see. There's also dapagliflozin, which is Farxiga, and there's Invokana, which is canagliflozin.
Say that 10 times fast.
I literally can't.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. Don't even get me started.
Yeah. Like, so just any of the flozins.
Yes, the flozin. That's how you have to remember it. Yeah. It's like the ending of the drug.
Yeah.
So these, like you said, they do have a cardiovascular benefit, which is one of the best parts of them, because we know our diabetes patients are at much higher risk for, you know, cardiovascular disease, CHS, CKD, and these medications help with that.
Yeah.
But the way that they work is actually the coolest mechanism. They block reabsorption. And so reabsorption of glucose. So all it makes you do is you pee out all of your sugar. You pee it out. And so because of that, it does work moderately. So it only reduces A1C up to about 1%. But because it's just blocking the reabsorption of your glucose and not increasing insulin production, there is no risk of hypoglycemia. It's very small.
Okay.
But because this is making you pee out your sugar, it can, you know, cause increased urine output. It can cause dehydration in our patients. It can also lower blood pressure. So in patients who are already fluid down or dehydrated, you might not want to be giving this to them. And in addition, it can cause very pronounced UTIs. It increases the risk of UTIs greatly, more in females than males, of course, just because of the anatomy. But if you have a patient who experiences that frequently, you don't want to give this to them because they will be struggling.
Yeah.
The other great thing about these medications is that they can also cause some moderate weight loss, which could be beneficial too.
Absolutely.
So these medications, I feel like they hit a lot of boxes. They check a lot of boxes for me and like what our patients need. So these are great medications. But yeah, like I said, really important to think about UTI. So if you have a patient with an active UTI in the hospital, probably don't want to give them their Guardians.
That's a lot of patients in the hospital.
It is absolutely. And so it's so hard to, you know, look at all the home medications right when they're ordered, you know, to figure out is this appropriate or not, especially when they all have these different mechanisms of action. And so just the most important thing to remember about this is it's making you pee out the sugar. So that can help you, you know, remember that you're increasing your urine output can cause dehydration and UTIs. And the only thing I would like to mention is there was a warning, black box warning for these drugs before for increased risk of amputations due to, you know, advanced diabetes. However, that warning has since been removed.
Hmm.
But, you know, because it was there in the past, you know, we still keep it in consideration. So if you do have a patient who has like history of like one BKA or anything like that, you know, any amputations, you might want to consider not using this. And so that would be more of like a primary care issue. But, you know, if your patient is at the hospital because they have a diabetic foot infection and they're gonna, you know, have an amputation and they're on this medication, it could be a point of discussion with the physician whether or not they should continue this after discharge.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good point. And like the good news is that there are a lot of other diabetic medications that they could take in place of this quite easily.
Exactly.
So let's talk about some of the other medications that we see too. So I guess seeing Januvia as well. So if we could talk about like that class of medications as well.
Yeah, of course. So these are the DPP-4 inhibitors. And so basically, these are an incretin mimetic. I know I'm saying these like crazy words. So basically, that means that it helps increase your natural insulin production, but it's in a glucose-dependent fashion. And so what that means is that it does cover your prandial glucoses with meals, but because it's in a glucose-dependent fashion, it does decrease that hypoglycemia risk. So again, this is an okay medication to take if your patient is NPO.
Okay. Okay. Is this, how come I don't see this very much? Is it just expensive, new?
I think most hospitals don't have this on formulary.
Yeah, I don't think so.
These are like a little bit newer, but you know, I've seen it. I think we have one of them at my hospital, but you know, if the patient, it's probably going to be like a patient owned med type thing at most hospitals.
Okay. Okay. So there are other classes that we haven't gone over, but they're honestly like pretty rarely seen. Is there any other class like you think is worth mentioning on the podcast today?
Yeah, I think the only other ones that you might see commonly would be the GLP-1 agonists. And so basically, if you think of those, these are like the injectable version of the Januvia. So the DPP-4 inhibitors, right, the way that they work is by increasing your endogenous GLP-1, which causes, you know, that extra insulin production in that glucose-dependent fashion. And those are oral medications. And then we created these other medications that go right to that GLP-1 and they agonize it themselves. So they kind of work in a pretty similar way, just like at different points in that pathway. And so these ones are injectable. So this is like your Trulicity, which you probably see on TV all the time.
Yes.
Ozempic. Yeah, it's like, do you want Trulicity? Ask your doctor.
I've definitely seen that commercial. I don't even watch TV and I've seen that commercial. Like, I don't know how that happens, but I've definitely seen it.
I feel like it's every other commercial is Trulicity. So these work in a similar way. And so these can also slow gastric motility. And so these are subcutaneous injections and most of them are like every 2 weeks, which is really good. Only one of them is PO and it's called Rybelsus, which is very, very expensive and it's not very easy to take. It's very food dependent and you have to eat a very high calorie meal for it to work. So I don't typically recommend that, but you'll probably see liraglutide pretty often or Victoza, which we can use also for weight loss. And so these ones will probably be the next most common that you would see.
Okay. But I could understand how they could be common in like outpatient, but definitely not inpatient.
Yeah. And I think a lot of that has to do with formulary and also physician comfortability with these agents, especially on the inpatient side. And so usually the easier thing is to just do a sliding scale. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I think that is the main classes of diabetes meds that, you know, I think you would see. Not that I am an endocrinologist specialist at all, but at least from my experience, definitely the metformin and those silly sulfonylureas, your glipizide, keep your eyes out for that. The only thing I want to mention just to solidify is your sulfonylureas are the ones that cause hypoglycemia if you're not eating. So glipizide, glyburide, glimepiride. And then there is another class, which you probably won't see, called miglitinides, which has nateglinide or Starlet. Those you cannot take if you're not eating as well. Okay. But hopefully you won't see those in the hospital too much.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point to bring up is that almost all of these oral diabetic medications do have that handy, like I keep calling it floor, but you know, they don't have that risk of hypoglycemia. But the one to look out for would be the sulfonylureas, the glipizide, glyburide, glimepiride.
Exactly. And, you know, it's not to say that the others can't cause a touch of hypoglycemia, but it's not going to be as pronounced as giving someone glipizide because that can really tank someone's sugars very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's really good to know. All right. Well, thank you, Tori, so much. I have learned a lot today and I think this is definitely going to, I don't know if it like changed my practice so much as, but make me more aware and be more diligent about vinco troughs and peaks and advocating for oral diabetic medications as appropriate for my patients.
Yeah. And what I think you know, that you said that like struck me is when you said, you know, if I understand why we're doing something, it makes it so much easier, you know, to make sure that happens.
Yes.
And I think as pharmacists, we forget that too. And like, we just have to make sure that we're like doing that for each other. So we have to, you know, just talk to your pharmacist and we'll talk to you. And, you know, if you don't understand something, you ask us because we love talking to you. And so, yeah, if anyone comes into my office, it's like, hey, can you explain this to me? I'm like, you sit your butt down and
I'll make you this nice drawing and diagram.
Yes, I will. I'll make you a picture and everything. And so, you know, we just have to remember, like, we have such different niche understanding of, you know, in our professions. And if we can give each other a little bit of knowledge here and there, I think, you know, things will be so much better.
For sure. I know for one that I'm more likely to like follow rules and directions if I understand why we're doing it, not mm-hmm. just to like cross off, like check yeah. boxes and create busy work. 'Cause, mm-hmm. but if we know like that we're truly like helping the patient and understand why, you know, we need to do all these lab draws, then like, I guess it's just ways like easier on my mind.
Yeah, absolutely. And then it increases the priority, you know, that doing this level will make a huge difference in, you know, our patient care. And so,
yeah,
I think it's great for everyone.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Annie. Thank you so much.
Be sure to check out some great pharmacy pearls that Tori mentioned on Twitter at TILEDPharmD. And check out the show notes for more info about what we just talked about. All right, that's it for today. I hope that you have upped your nursing game.